James. I'm one of the staff of the Centre for Open Learning. On behalf of the Centre and UCT, to welcome you particularly to this lecture. I've seen quite a few faces that I remember from last year, sitting in roughly the same seats that you sat in last year. So there's almost a question as to whether I need to introduce David to you at all. But for those of you who may not know, not only is he well known as a physicist, a scientist, perhaps most famously for his work at CERN in Geneva. There is, however, another side to David, which perhaps is less well known, except amongst perhaps a few of his colleagues. There's often a great debate in universities about the relationship between research and teaching. And there's always a sense in which you're either a teacher or a researcher. We're talking here about a man who has an unparalleled record as a researcher, but has been recipient of numerous awards for teaching across nearly every level of education, not only in high schools, but into universities and beyond, and also for teaching something unusual in mainstream physics. He taught the philosophy of science. So we have a man who brings philosophy and science together in a special way. He was a leading figure in the establishment of initiatives to include students from disadvantaged backgrounds into the study of science, something in which he still invests considerable energy and time, benefiting students here at UCT. Because having finished here, he goes on to teach students in their first year at UCT. He was a leading figure in developing and maintaining international collaboration and cooperation among scientists across the East-West divide. He worked as a leading figure in the Oppenheimer Institute for Science and International Cooperation, which was founded in 2000, and contributes to the utilization of science and international cooperation to reduce tension and to promote sustainable advances in social and economic justice, education, health, and environmental integrity. So we have a physicist who's an environmentalist and a worker for peace. He's lectured on subjects as wide-ranging as intellectual property within the context of international scientific collaboration and on technology commercialization. On top of that, he's found time to be a world-class physicist. So it is with great pleasure and considerable respect that I welcome David to speak to us today.
Well, thank you, Kevin. I'm a little taken aback by all of that. Wish I knew who that person was. Anyway, it is a joy to be here yet again, and a pleasure to see all of you. And I'm always so both pleased to be here, to have escaped from the snow and freezing cold in London, and to see so many people interested in learning science, particularly to see a few young people here as well, which is always very encouraging. Before I start with talking about astronomy, I want to mention a few things that I promised to do for those of you who might have been here last year. Last year I spoke about the Large Hadron Collider and about the Higgs boson and so forth. And there have been a lot of developments, and let me just spend about 2 minutes talking about that, because it does appear that we have a Higgs boson, however. In physics, there are basically four fundamental forces. There's gravity, and we know about gravity because it makes things fall down to the ground. There's electricity and magnetism, we know about that, and the biggest revolution perhaps in the entire history of humankind has been the invention of the electric light, and it changes our world from darkness and the fear of animals and eating us at night to one of tremendous brightness. It's taken away the joys of the night sky to a large extent. We'll talk about that. There's also two special forces. There is the force which is responsible for radioactive decay. This is called the weak force. And then, of course, there has to be something to hold the protons together inside the nucleus against the repulsion of electrically charged particles that have the same charge. And that's called the strong force. Now, we've made a lot of progress in the last 20 or 30 years, because what we would like to have is one force. We would like one force that would describe things. And about 30 years ago, it was possible to combine the electric force and the weak force into one possible force at higher energies than we normally see. That's called the electroweak force. We have a theory called the standard model, which almost puts together the electroweak and the strong forces. Not quite, but close to being able to do that. And that's the best we can do. We have made no progress, really, to speak of putting gravity together with those other forces. Now, the standard model, as it is called, makes a lot of predictions. It wants the Higgs boson to be there to provide mass to elementary particles, but it makes no prediction about what the mass of the Higgs itself should be. And so people have looked for it for years and years. And in July of last year, a very important announcement was made at CERN of the discovery of a particle which is roughly 125 times heavier than the proton, so one of the heaviest objects ever discovered on the subatomic scale. As such a heavy object, it quickly decays into lighter particles. It's a bit way in which it decays and so forth. All of those decay modes are strongly predicted by the standard model. So we know how it should behave. And what has been found is that so far, there's still a lot of research to be done, a lot of data analysis to be done. What has been found so far is what has been painfully described as a rather boring Higgs. That is, it would appear that the particle that has been discovered is exactly the Higgs that would be predicted by the standard model. Now, the standard model is not perfect, and we would like a better model, but this particular particle so far does not look like it's going to provide us information about, say, what dark matter is, or whether or not there's supersymmetric particles such as this electron or this proton or whatever. So now the LHC is going to turn off very shortly for a refurbishment, and it will come back in 2015 at twice the energy, and then perhaps we will know more. But still, that's where we are. So I will stop at that point and start talking about astronomy. Now, I call this course The Birth of Modern Astronomy, but there's nothing modern about what I'm going to say. So if you think I'm going to talk about the square kilometer array or any of these things, that's all wrong. Everything I talk about will stop in 1630 with the death of Johannes Kepler. So it's the history and the birth of modern astronomy. It's not the state of modern astronomy in any sense. Okay. I want to start with a quote from one of the giants of modern physics, Stephen Hawking. And he says, "We now have a tendency to dismiss as primitive the earlier world picture of Aristotle and Ptolemy, in which the Earth was at the center and the Sun went around it. However, we should not be too scornful of their model, which was anything but simple-minded. It incorporated Aristotle's deduction that the Earth is a round ball rather than a flat plate, and it was reasonably accurate in its main function, that of predicting the apparent positions of the heavenly bodies in the sky for astrological purposes. In fact, it was about as accurate as the heretical suggestion put forward in 1543 by Copernicus that the Earth and the planets moved in circular orbits around the Sun. Galileo found Copernicus's proposal convincing, not because it better fit the observations of planetary positions, but because of its simplicity and elegance in contrast to the complicated epicycle of the Ptolemaic model." And we will talk a fair amount about that. So the problem is the difficulty of putting putting ourselves back in the mindset of people before. Historians, and I'll quote one, say, that the difficulty is we must learn to look with less knowledgeable eyes. So I want to start with some definitions, and here's the first definition, and it's on the sheet that I printed out for you. Astronomy, which tells us about the constitution, the relative position, the positions and the motions of the heavenly bodies. And it comes, this is the definition from the Oxford English Dictionary. Its etymology is from the word astronomia, and that's astro, the Greek for star, and omia from arranging of. And then there is also the word cosmology, which comes from the study of the world, and that is a different thing, the science or theory of the universe as an ordered whole and of the general laws which govern it. Now, astronomy and cosmology are not the same thing, although today we are assumed they are intimately related. Virtually every culture has asked the cosmological question of what is the structure of the universe. But it's especially the Greeks and their descendants that have looked at the appearance of the heavens for an answer. Systematic observations of the sky are relatively recent, at least in comparison to questions about the structure of the universe. Most early cosmologies were shaped by terrestrial events rather than by heavenly ones. After all, the earth and our lives are full of change all the time. There's birth, there's growth, there's death. These things go on quite regularly. The heavens, of course, look much less changeable. The changes occurred only very slowly, and they occurred with obvious recurrences. Thus, as far back as the days of Babylon, we've looked at the heavens for help in trying to understand change. This was the reason that astrology, that most ancient of stellar interests, began. After all, if we wonder about what controls our lives, we can have a sort of an indeterminate thing. Well, it's the will of the god or the gods or whatever that does this to us. Or we can have a very determinate picture, one that lacks free will, in which the stars and the position of the planet Jupiter or Saturn or Mars or whatever, when you were born or when you were conceived, that is controlling your life. That whole idea of the lack of free will comes into a lot of conflict with the Christian church, of course, as we shall see. Now, to make a more secure base for astrological predictions, however, a careful study of the sky became necessary. Moreover, most people were busy leading their lives, getting enough food to eat, taking care of their kids, and so forth, and didn't have a lot of time to spend studying just where all the planets and stars were. And so this, in the days of the Babylonians, was left to the priestly class. And the Babylonians acquired a remarkable knowledge of the motions of the stars, the sun, the moon, and the planets. Water, that most valuable of resources in such an arid country, was the basis of much of their early attempts of cosmology. And we find many passages in the Old Testament that are quite similar to things that we find on clay tablets from the Babylonians. And of particular importance is a passage in Genesis 1, verses 6 and 7, and this will come back several times. And God said, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters." And God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and there was evening and there was morning a second day. This passage caused huge controversy in the Middle Ages because water and earth are the heavy elements, air and fire are the light elements. How can we then have water, this heavy element, above the firmament? That might seem not important to us, but to Thomas Aquinas, that really mattered. And we'll come back to that. Now, in Egypt, again, water played a great part, as cosmology was generated by the appearance of the Nile. This was the only world that people really knew. Thus, the earth for the Egyptians was an elongated platter. They had gone quite far up the Nile to the south, and whose length was similar to that of the Nile, and it had edges which were mountains, and those were the edges of the world. It had a curved river rim. This flat platter was supported by water, and water was a god, and the sky above was air, and that was also a god, and this god supported a dome that incorporated the stars. The sun was, of course, also a god, the god Ra, which traveled across the sun across the heavens at night, and then went underneath the water to come back to the east. During the day, and then come back to the east over the night. The stars were also minor gods. Similar cosmologies grew up in India, and from anthropologists I've spoken to, if they are in contact with tribes even today that have had little contact with outside civilizations, they still find similar sorts of cosmologies even amongst those people. The Greeks, however, appear to have been the very first peoples to demand that cosmology also explain observed phenomena and to search for such explanations. So this marriage, if you like, between observation, astronomy, and explanation, cosmology, is not always a happy one. It's often true that astronomers destroyed long-held beliefs of a majority of the members of society. And this is certainly true of the ideas initiated by Copernicus. Albert Einstein once remarked that there's no difficulty in understanding why China or India did not create modern science. The problem is rather why Europe did, for in Einstein's words, science is a most arduous and unlikely undertaking. Again, it's hard for us who, unless you live out in the Karoo or some area where there's not a lot of electric light, it's hard for us to understand how important the stars were to the ancients. After all, shepherds on the hillside or farmers looking up at night and wondering what the weather was going to be like the next day, they had to pay a great deal of attention, and they were very interested in the skies. Well before recorded history, people had made patterns out of stars, which we call constellations, groups of neighboring stars that could be grouped together and recognized as a fixed pattern. This then made their identification night after night to be easier, though, so I could say Regal is the star in the knee, or I think it is of Orion, and Betelgeuse is the star in the shoulder, etc. Now, when I refer to dates, I've noticed that modern historians refer to dates no longer as BC and AD, but rather as BCE, before the Common Era, and CE, the Common Era, so I would probably do that. As early as 3000 BCE, in clay tablets from Babylon, we find pictures of constellations. And it's hard for us, for example, to see a bear in Ursa Major, or to see twins in the constellation Gemini. But we human beings obviously make patterns out of things that we see. It's very common, I know I do it, to see shapes in clouds, where you see recognizable things. And I'm told by psychologist friends that Gestalt psychology uses this technique in Rorschach tests. Now, in the constellation of Ursa Major, which is easily visible in the northern hemisphere, there is a figure that's called the plow, and it has a handle which sort of looks like that, and then the shape of the bowl itself, of the iron part here. And these two stars at the far edge, if you follow them along, they point to a faint star in the sky called Polaris, and that star sits directly over the North Pole, the celestial North Pole. with all the stars revolve about that point. In this hemisphere, of course, there is the Southern Cross, which points toward the southern celestial pole. And even though during the night the stars rotate, the direction of Polaris and the direction of the Southern Cross are always pointing in exactly the same direction. Now, from these pole directions, north and south pole, we can make a celestial sphere, okay, with an equator and so forth. And what was quickly found, and here's a picture of the celestial sphere, the north celestial pole and the south celestial pole, so that would be the star Polaris, and that would be the direction towards which the Southern Cross points. What was quickly found is that the sun moves not along the celestial equator, but along this curve, which is tilted with respect to the celestial equator by 23.5 degrees. And it crosses the celestial equator at two points, which are the equinoxes, the time when night and therefore there are 12 hours of day and 12 hours of night, spring and autumnal equinox, which is the 21st of September and the 21st of March. At the ends here are the solstices, the summer and northern, summer and winter solstices, again, depending on which hemisphere you are. Another picture in full color of this, there's the plane, this is called the ecliptic plane, the plane in which the sun moves, and there's the celestial equator, and there we see the celestial latitudes. Notice that the longitudes are not measured in degrees, but are measured in hours, in time, which is very common in astronomy. I found all kinds of pictures. Now, there is the celestial equator. Here is the visual horizon on Earth, because the ecliptic, relative to our visual horizon on the surface of the Earth, moves. It moves farthest north on the 21st of June and farthest south on the 25th of December. And those are the summer and winter solstices. And it crosses the equator by the autumnal and vernal equinoxes. Now, I have one last picture I'd like. So I put in lots of them. If you look at these stars in the northern hemisphere, never set, and these stars in the summer and southern hemisphere, never set. And if you are in the northern hemisphere, you can never see these stars. And if you're in the summer and southern hemisphere, you can't see these stars. In particular, you can't see Polaris. But the fact that a lot of stars are visible only in the southern hemisphere is one of the reasons for the square kilometer array and one of the reasons for the huge visual observatory in the desert of Chile called Atacama. Now, I want to look at the at questions of time, and because the creation of calendars is one of the earliest of astronomical activities. And most of us are no longer aware, again, of this kind, but our ancestors certainly were. We know that today is the 21st of January, and that's warm here and freezing cold in London, and that the weather is likely to be the same tomorrow, but in 3 months, it's likely to be quite different. But to our ancestors, this was not so, because one day being very much like another, how could people keep track of what was going on? How would they know, for example, when to plant crops, or how to cite their religious festivals, or when to plan the ends of contracts and so forth? And so they would. So they wanted to create calendars to keep track of this. Now, if we erect a stick. A vertical stick on the surface of the Earth. Such a stick is called a gnomon, G-N-O-N-O-N, from the Greek word for an indicator. And such a stick casts a shadow. And there is a picture of the shadow.
It's longest at sunrise and at sunset, and roughly in opposite directions at those two times. When the shadow is shortest, it's always in the same direction, and that direction is south in this hemisphere and north in the northern hemisphere. Moreover, when the shadow is shortest, that defines for us what we call noon, the middle of the day. High noon, which is right, because the sun is at its highest point in the sky. There's still a problem, because our ancestors, even 5,000 years ago, were aware that there were two definitions of the day. The time from noon on one day to the next day is 24 hours by our time scale. But if you look at the night sky and not the day sky, and you look at the position of the star, and you wait until that star comes back to exactly the same position, that's called the stellar day, and its length is not 24 hours. On average, it's 23 hours and 56 minutes. And people knew 5,000 years ago this was different. I will continually express my amazement at what people could tell and what they knew so many thousands of years ago. At noon, the position of the sun does change over the years. So that, for example, if I take and I point up at the sun a piece of cardboard and I make a hole in it and I look at the shadow of that hole on the ground and I mark it on the ground every day for a whole year, I find the following shape. This is called an anagramma, and it's obviously taken in the northern hemisphere. There is the summer solstice at the top of the winter solstice. Here are the equinoxes. 21st of March of this year, the 23rd of December. And here are the months plotted out in this lovely figure 8 drawing. So we've got both these definitions of the day, and that's fine. We've got a stellar or sidereal day, which is a little bit shorter than the solar day. The year, however, from one vernal equinox to the next vernal equinox is much, much more difficult to calculate. But obviously a very important thing. This is why calendars are useful. The Babylonians created the first calendar we know of, and their calendar had 360 days in it. Now, 360 days was a very useful number for the Babylonians because they had a numbering system which was a sexagesimal system, that it was based not on 10 like ours or on 8 like some computer systems, but rather on the number 60. 60 is a very nice number because it's divisible by 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. And so 360 was a very useful number, even though we well know that it's longer than 360 days. But we have lots of remnants from their system. Like we have 60 seconds in a minute and 60 minutes in an hour and 360 degrees in a circle, etc. These are all remnants of our Babylonian ancestors. Now, the Egyptians, in order to keep the calendar in line with the seasons, added 5 days. And so we came up with a year of 365 days. But this is also too short. And so if you live a long enough time, after about 40 years, the calendar is about 10 days out of sync with the systems, with the seasons, rather. And so way back in 46 BC, BCE, I should say, Julius Caesar ordered a change made to the calendar, and he added one quarter of a day to the calendar by adding a leap year or a leap day every 4 years. And that's, of course, the 29th of February in our calendar, which occurs every 4 years. And so this is the Julian calendar, which lasted its civilization for about 1,500 years. So it was around a long time. But it, too, is wrong. And it's too long by 11 minutes and 14 seconds. Now, that doesn't seem like very much, and it isn't very much, but in 1500 years, it's a lot. And so by the year, by the 16th century, we were, the vernal equinox in the northern hemisphere, which is where most people were, was occurring not on the 21st of March, but on the 11th of March. And this really mattered, because according to the Catholic Church, the festival of Easter had to occur on the first Sunday after the first full moon after the vernal equinox. And if it keeps moving earlier, it's going to be closer to Christmas than Easter. And so a correction was necessary. And there was a lot of discussion in the 16th century about calendar reform. And eventually it was ordered in 1582 by Pope Gregory XIII. And what he did was change the leap year by a teeny tiny amount, such that every century year, that is 1600, 1700, 1800, etc., would only be a leap year if it was divisible by four. And so 1600 was a leap year, 2000 was a leap year, but 1700, 1800, 1900 were not leap years. And so the formula then becomes 365 plus a quarter for leap days, minus 1/100 to take out those years, but plus 1/400 to put back. And this gives us a year of 365.2425 days, and that's pretty good. Now, this change was ordered in 1582 by a Catholic pope, but it was only about 50 years later that a man named Martin Luther in the city of Wittenberg in Germany had nailed 95 theses to the cathedral door and created what we now know as the Protestant Reformation. And so the Protestant churches, which were primarily Lutheran in those times, but there were others, the Protestant church would have nothing to do with a change ordered by a Catholic pope. And so the Protestant countries did not adopt what is now we call the Gregorian calendar. And it took a long time. For example, I think England only adopted the Gregorian calendar, I think it was in 1732, by which time the calendar was 11 days out of sync with the Julian calendar. And there were riots all over the country as people demanded their 11 days back. Where had they gone? Even today, however, there are countries which do not use the Gregorian calendar. I'm told neither Nepal or Saudi Arabia nor Iran use the Gregorian calendar. Still, now we have definitions of the day and of the year. And we need to create this comprehensible model of the universe. Now, I want to go back to the Greeks. From the time of Pythagoras and his school, and he died in southern Italy about 500 BCE, there was the idea of the spherical earth taking shape. The Pythagoreans apparently left no writings because they were a very secretive order, but we have information from about them from other people, starting with the philosopher Philolaus, who lived in southern Italy where the Pythagoreans lived. Who lived shortly after the death of Pythagoras. And of course, most of us know Pythagoras only from this theorem about right triangles, but he had a whole school, and their primary idea was the idea of harmony, and it is from them we get the word, the music of the spheres. Now, I need to talk a little bit about Greek philosophy, and this always bothers me, because I'm sure there are people here who know much more about philosophy than I do. And so what I say is extremely facile and only touches the surface of things, and so I apologize. But I want to talk about the people I think of as the greatest minds, in particular in human history, people like Plato and Aristotle. Plato seems not to have been much interested in physical science, but rather in an ideal world. the idea and the, is, as the example of pure existence is the sole object of real knowledge for him. So there's a conflict, obviously, between the ideal of the idea and matter, which is corruptible and changes. And you can only attain absolute truth with unchangeable and eternal ideas. So he doesn't give us, despite writing the Timaeus, much detail about his cosmos, and he mingles mythology and concepts of science. He imagines a universe which is based on the best possible shape, the ideal shape, which to him is the sphere. It's the and the whole idea which permeates astronomy for thousands of years, of the ideas of spheres, spherical motion, circular motion, this all originates, comes about from Plato. The great American philosopher and historian Alfred North Whitehead said that all of philosophy is only a series of comments on Plato, which is maybe a little bit of an exaggeration, but has a lot of truth in it. For him, the heavens are a large sphere which rotates every 24 hours. The Earth sits at the center of this sphere. And since there's no down from the center, the Earth can't fall anywhere, and that's why it stays in its place. Now, for Plato, there are, from the philosopher Eratosthenes, who lived before, there are four fundamental elements that we know, of course: earth, air, fire, and water. And there is a fifth element, the quintessential fifth element, the ether, the perfection, which is all of the universe outside the orbit of the moon. And Plato, knowing his geometry, knows that there are five perfect solids, the five Platonic solids. These are the only solids which can be made from a fixed finite number of identical two-dimensional objects. And he associates each of these five solids with one of the five elements. There is the tetrahedron. This is all allegorical stuff here at the bottom: earth, air, fire, water. But these are real. The tetrahedron made of four equilateral triangles, the cube made of six squares, the octahedron, eight equilateral triangles, the dodecahedron out of 12 pentagons, and the icosahedron out of 20 equilateral triangles: earth, water, air, fire, and the quintessence, this perfect stuff. Now, by the time of Aristotle, we have more or less a universe that makes sense. If we go back and think about the great philosopher Thales, who lived about 600 BCE in Miletus in Asia Minor, and his particular followers, who were Anaximenes and Anaximander. And I wrote a little bit on that blurred sheet that you've got about Thales. He's the first person we have recorded in history who asked what the universe is actually made of, not what the universe is or what the structure of the universe is, which cultures had asked for millennia, but what is it made of? And his answer was water, because water seems so fundamental to life. It's involved in birth and in life, etc. But it's not the answer, it's the question. And what I like about Thales, in particular, as I noted on that handout sheet, is he's recorded to have been looking up at the stars, wandering around one night, and fell down a well. He apparently did not kill himself, but I think that makes him the sort of the patron saint of absent-minded professors. Another person during this time who is famous and well-known is Eudoxus, who studied with Plato and seemed to have studied in Egypt as well. He was a really fine mathematician, is credited with writing one of the books of Euclid's Geometry. But he is the first person we know of who seemed to take the circles of the motions of things in the heavens and add little circles to them, which we will come to a lot in the next couple of days, called epicycles, to try to make better explanations of how things work. And he had a student whose name is Helicon, and Helicon is the first known person who was, the first person we know of, who was able to predict the occurrence of an eclipse based on Eudoxus' model. Now, in Aristotle's universe, again, he uses Plato's idea of circular and spherical motion, but in his discussion of cosmology, the Cato of the heavens, these have Latin titles, you know, just because they came into the Western world through Latin, not through Greek. In this book, he uses purely metaphysical arguments. The sphere is the most perfect shape, and because it's bounded by a single surface. Of course, any figure of revolution, like an egg, is also bounded by a single surface, but a sphere is universal, has the same distance from the center in all possible directions. For him, the most perfect sphere is the one that moves the fastest, and the one that moves the fastest is, in fact, the one that's farthest away, namely the sphere of the stars, which rotate every 24 hours. The fact, and again, I have trouble also putting myself back in this mindset, how could they imagine these stars, which are so far away, could go at such an incredible speed that they could get around in 24 hours, or in 23 hours and 56 minutes? Quite remarkable to me. Nonetheless, this was the most perfect sphere, and that's why it was made out of this perfect element, the quintessential element, the ether, rather than any of the other things. Now, the four earthly elements to Aristotle can only travel in straight lines, earth and water down, air and fire up. But circular motion is reserved for the perfect things that are in the made of the quintessential ether element. And this is why, for Aristotle, the earth cannot rotate, because the earth cannot move in a circle, because the earth's made of earth and water, and it's not one of the ideal, it's not of the ideal substance. It has to move only in straight lines. The stars are not hot, not composed of fire, but they glow because of the friction as they rub through the ether on the spheres on which they are moving. He doesn't like the Pythagorean idea of the music of the sphere because we can't hear it. And the Pythagoreans said that we can't hear this music because it's on all the time, and so it's background noise that we ignore. But he throws that argument out, which is quite reasonable. He recognizes, as I said, the idea that the earth could rotate, but again, because it's made of earthly stuff, it can't move in a circle. It only has to move in straight lines. He did, however, note, and this is one of his observational things, of which he did not do many, he did note that the earth was round. And he knew this, he said, because during a lunar eclipse, if you look at the shadow of the earth on the moon, it's curved. Now, that means not only did he know the earth was round, but he knew that the eclipse was caused by the earth blocking the light of the sun going toward the moon, which means he knew a lot. But he also mentions the fact that being in a maritime culture like the Greeks, if a ship sails away, and if the earth is flat, the ship would just sort of disappear. But when you watch a ship sail away, the hull of the ship would disappear before the mast, as if it's going over a curve. Moreover, he adds as a third point, that when the Egyptians traveled far south up the Nile, that they found that the positions of the stars in the heavens changed. And so all of these ideas led him to believe that the earth was round. Quite a serious thing, I think. one serious word of another serious word of caution about the Greeks. We don't have any of their original writings. Everything we know, say, about Aristotle comes from people who lived hundreds of years after him and who repeated his writings, and we have that material. It's possible, not likely, I think, but possible that he wrote quite different things than we have, and it was colored by the copyists of 500 or 600 years later. And that's what we have recorded today. So we just don't know. But the idea that every object requires something to move it fit very well with medieval Christian theology of the idea that there must be a prime mover, which the Christians, of course, considered to be God. Although Plato and Aristotle certainly dominate what we know about Greek philosophy, they were not the only ones. There was, of course, a theory that matter consisted of atoms, not of the four elements, proposed by Democritus, and in cosmology, there was Heraclitus, who predicted that the Earth, that the Earth revolved once a day about its axis. Now, Alexander the Great was a student of Aristotle. Lucky man. His father, Philip of Macedon, was the king, so that even in those days, the people could hire the best teachers. And one of the greatest experiences of my life was visiting a recently excavated place in Macedonia called Bergina, where was the palace of Philip, where he was assassinated. And I was allowed to walk across a mosaic floor where Aristotle and Alexander must themselves have walked, which was just astounding. Now, he, of course, as everybody knows, conquered much of the known world, in fact, a considerable amount of the unknown world at that time. And he died at a very young age, 323 BCE, at about some 33 years of age. But his lifetime corresponded to pretty much the rise of Stoic philosophy in Greece. And the Stoic philosophers were also connected with the founding of the Museum of Alexandria. Now, after he died, this enormous empire was divided up amongst his generals. His general Seleucus got the area we would now call Syria and Iraq and Israel and so forth. And in fact, 100 years or so later, when the Israelis rebelled against the Seleucid Greeks and succeeded, at least for a while, that rebellion is celebrated in the festival of Hanukkah, which occurred just last month. In Egypt was controlled by General Ptolemy Soter, and Ptolemy Soter, given his name Ptolemy to many, many people who came after him, and he founded the Museum of Alexandria. A museum is a place that's dedicated to the muses, or the goddesses of nine goddesses, poetry, song, history, astronomy, etc. The muse of astronomy is named Urania, which is where we get the name of the planet Uranus. The Museum of Alexandria is best known because it had this famous library, but it also was incredibly involved in making astronomical observations of the sky. But it was not the only place at the time. There was great interest on the island of Rhodes and interest on the island of Samos. And on Samos, there was a man named Aristarchus, who was born shortly after the death of Aristotle, who died in 322 BCE. And Aristarchus postulated a system which we would recognize as a heliocentric system, a system in which the sun sits at the center of the universe and the planets revolve around it. But it appears that he just sort of put this out as an idea and never put any mathematics to it, never pushed it very hard, and so it disappeared. Had it not, brilliant mathematicians who came after him, such as Apollonius created what we would now call the theory of the mathematics of conic sections, that is the theory that describes mathematically straight lines, circles, ellipses, hyperbole and parabole, a brilliant contribution. And he was only one of many really clever people who followed Aristarchus. And had this been a more serious theory, we could well have had Copernicus 1800 years before Copernicus, which would have changed a lot about the history of the world. One of the things that Aristarchus did is he calculated the distance to the moon. I wouldn't know how to do that, but he knew how to do that. And he calculated his unit of measurement was the diameter of the Earth, which he didn't know. So he said it was about a little under 40 Earth diameters, well, it's a little under 30 Earth diameters. But it's a pretty good guess. Shortly after his death, Eratosthenes, who lived in Egypt from 276 to 195 BC, measured the diameter of the Earth. And this is just astonishing to me. Eratosthenes was a surveyor. Surveying was very important in ancient Egypt. After all, there was only a finite amount of arable land on either side of the Nile. When a farmer died and he had several sons, and the sons got to inherit the land, I guess his daughters didn't matter, but his sons got to inherit the land, it had to be divided up equally. And equally meant it had to be measured, and so there was a need for surveyors. And so he was a surveyor. He lived in Alexandria, and he noticed on a given day that the sun from his nomon made an angle of 7.5 degrees with the vertical at noon. But someone told him that on the same day, in the city farther to the south of Cyrene, the sun was directly overhead because they could see the reflection at the bottom of a well at noon. And so he said, oh my goodness, look, here it's straight up, and here it's at an angle. And that's okay, because if the sun is really far away, then this 7.5 degree angle at the surface of the Earth must also be a 7.5 degree angle at the center of the Earth. The Greeks, who knew a lot of geometry, knew that if you have a pie slice out of a circle, and if you know the angle of the slice, and if you know this, the arc length across there, you could calculate the radius. And so he knew the angle, he needed the circumference. Well, in those days he had a number of slaves, and he had one walk the distance, several thousand stade, his unit. Stade is the unit of the stadium length, and we don't know really which stadium length he had in mind, because they were all a little different. But if we use what people, historians, think is the best stade, we come up with an answer for the diameter of the Earth, which is about 5% too high. Now, I ask any of you to go out and make a measurement sometime of the diameter of the Earth, the 5%, and never mind. It's just not, you just want, who the hell would not do that? Now, what happened with this incredible flow of data that started to come in from the school of the museum at Alexandria was that people just gave up trying to figure out what really happened in the heavens. After all, what they were interested in was the ability to know where the planets were for astrological purposes and to predict eclipses. So what they wanted was predictability. They wanted numbers. And so any mathematical system, not a physical system, not really what went on, but in a calculational tool of what happened, that's what people were interested in. And And they were able to make remarkable advances in this information. Even with the crude instruments they had in their day. Now, most of what, most of what we know about the Greek, about the ancient Greeks, comes from the people we have come to call the Neoplatonists, who lived from about 300 to 600 in this era. And amongst these, the most important was probably a man who went by the peculiar name of Simplicius, simpleton. And he came from somewhere in southern Turkey. We don't, I'm not quite sure where. And he says, tells us that that there was basically no cosmological ideas. There was no physical explanation of truth because there were just too many problems. For example, the visibility, the brightness of the planet Venus, which is up in the morning sky. It would change during the year. Mars is low on the horizon right now, and it's very dull, but sometimes it's quite bright, and sometimes it becomes the brightest object in the sky after the moon and Venus in the night sky. So the brightness of planets changed over time, which this meant that they couldn't be the same distance from the Earth all the time because they get dimmer and brighter. And that's in terrible conflict with all this spherical motion, etc. So that's one of the reasons I think that people gave up looking for real tools. So that in the 400 years after Aristarchus, there were these great mathematicians such as Apollonius, this person who did all the conic section work. There was Hipparchus, who is considered to be the father of trigonometry, a subject that I'm sure many of you loved at school. And Hipparchus developed sufficiently accurate tables of the motions of the sun and moon to be able to make really good measurements, predictions of eclipses. The instruments that the people had were not just sticks and pointers at Alexandria, but they had astrolabes, things that looked like that. And that's a hell of a complicated looking device. I'm not quite sure how it worked. But it is the original GPS system of the world. pointers and dials and stuff here. I mean, it could tell you your position on the Earth. And this was presumably invented by Hipparchus. And they also had three-dimensional astrolabes called armillary spheres. And here you see an armillary sphere is the center of the Earth. Here is the celestial equator. Here is the zodiac, which is basically the ecliptic. And you can see on here the tropical of Cancer, the tropical of Capricorn, the Arctic Circle, the Arctic Circle, etc. All of this was apparently invented by Hipparchus. And so this was the primary instrument before the invention of the telescope, which did not happen until 1607, for determining the positions of objects in the sky. Again, and I want to stop now, and we'll come back to this ancient stuff tomorrow. The knowledge that people had of long-term variations of what happened, really long-term, much longer, and I'll talk about one where they knew about a 26,000-year variation in the heavens, that they knew so long ago, thousands of years ago, is just astonishing to me. They were incredibly intelligent people and very well worth, I think, paying attention to. So I will stop here. Tomorrow we will talk about the first calendars and how to make a calendar. Lots of numbers in the first calendar. So, if there are any questions, I...